Hi.
I'm Kylie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Kylie. I was just telling Chris I taught yoga in here a few years ago. And I taught the guys in here, and I taught the women over there. And there's this one pose where you lay down on your stomach and you put your hands behind your head. And I said, this is called Makrasana. And a guy said, this isn't Makrasana. This is your under arrest pose. I tell that story all the time when I teach class. Anyways, I'm really grateful to be here. And thanks, Chris, for asking me to be here. And I got sober in November 14th in 2004. And like you said, I sat in meetings with Chris, and I used to watch him talk, and it was a beginner's meeting, and the first 30 minutes, only the beginners could share, and then the last 30 minutes, the older people would share, or people had more time, and they would all, like, be screaming, and, you know, like, raising, not screaming, but, like, raising their hand, trying to share, and I was always really excited to be able to hear Chris share and hear what he had to say, and... So that's funny. I have three kids, so I'm glad the babies are okay. Cause I was like hearing the baby and I was thinking, somebody needs to help the baby. So anyways, I was born in Houston, Texas and yep, H-Town. And, I've had a pretty normal childhood. I didn't have anything particularly, exciting or terrible happen. You know, which to me just goes to show, you know, alcoholism is not a situational, you know, disease. It's, I believe, something that, you know, I was born with. It runs in my family. And I think, you know, about middle school is when I started drinking. You know, I started drinking, started smoking, started doing drugs, and kind of went in and out of, you know, I would either be like, driving to the worst parts of town to get, you know, cocaine, or I'd be like singing in the church choir. You know, there was never like any in between. It was like I'd swing hard this way and swing hard that way. And pretty much, you know, same story as most of y'all. You know, it's like the first time I ever drank, I thought, why would I ever want to feel any other way? You know, it was like, that warm, fuzzy feeling, and for me, it was immediate. It was I got blacked out drunk the first time I got drunk, and it was pretty much always like that. You know, I got sober when I was 24. I don't want to spend too much time actually talking about like my drunk log because it's. I mean, you've lived it. You know what it looks like. You know you know the story. You've lived it. So, and nothing. You know. I think there were a couple of moments where, you know, like I had been so drunk, I was holding myself up in the shower and then like getting dressed to go get more drunk and doing cocaine while I was putting on my makeup on and, you know, looking in the mirror and just kind of having those moments of like, this is how it is. Like, this is my life. This is never going to be any different. Like, this is, you know, and, the night before I got sober, it was kind of a similar thing. You know, there were lots of, look, I overdosed, I did all the things, I earned my chair, but the night before I got sober, it was kind of the same thing. I had decided I was only going to drink wine and I was going to stop doing drugs and, you know, and I was sitting there drunk with my drug dealer and she was like, it's not that bad, you know, like, you're not that bad, it's okay. And I just thought, no, like, this is, I've tried this, and the result's been the same. You know, I end up drunk, and I have no idea what's going to happen, you know? And so somebody had talked to me about going to AA earlier on, and my response to her was, well, I think I'm just going to try to drink beer and see how that goes, you know? Like, and so... I had known about AA, and so that was how I came into it. I never went to rehab. I didn't really have the opportunity. So I went to a noon meeting, and in the middle of the serenity prayer, I had my voicemail had the sound of a champagne cork popping. And so I had turned my ringer off, but my voicemail, I don't know, I had like one of those Razor phones or something at the time. It was 2004. And in the Serenity Prayer, you know, the champagne cork popped. But I sat in that meeting and I don't remember. I remember thinking like, okay, these are my people. But I just kept coming back, you know. And that's what they told me to do in the beginning. They said, you know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor right away, you know, do service work. So I'd like show up with donuts so I could eat donuts, and I'd clean the bathroom, you know, I'd make coffee and clean up, and I got a sponsor right away. And I did. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Sometimes I would go twice. You know, I had been bartending, and I would do my side work, and then I would get out of there and I'd go to the 10:30 meeting at Westlake. You know, and I got a sponsor right away, and I got the sponsor that I asked her to sponsor me because she was wearing Chucks and I wore Chucks. And so I thought, okay, well, she's got to be cool. So I asked her, and I remember I did my first four step, at the old Bolden Creek Cafe at the old location in Austin. And, you know, I did my first, when I first did my third step, she took me to a Catholic church right down the street, and we said the third step prayer. I had no idea what I was doing, but you know, I just kept doing what she told me to. And little by little, you know, things were getting better. I got sober November 14th, and I remember at Christmas time I was working on my four step. Like, I really dug in. And then at about, well, here's a good detour story for you. This is a juicy. I think I had like 30 days of sobriety. And I think that's about right. I had 30 days of sobriety, and I met my first husband in an AA meeting. It's like boy meets girl on the AA campus. And, you know, I think it's not like a moral thing, you know, why we don't get into relationships and do all those things in our first year of sobriety. It's more that given a little time under our belt, you know, we might pick somebody different. I used to be able to tell this story and hold up my hand, and I didn't have a ring on anymore. But, you know, I married my first husband, and we had two kids, and we were married for 5 years. And, you know, he was 10 years older than me, and I had made that relationship and that man my higher power. And so when that relationship fell apart, I did too, you know. And it was a really difficult circumstances as to why it fell apart. And but like Chris said, through the whole thing, I was sponsored and I was working steps and I was looking at my part. And I was, you know, able, even though the circumstances around it, I could have even easily played, you know, the victim card and been like, well, this isn't my fault. I had to look at the places, you know, where I had placed myself in the position to be harmed, and look at that squarely. And that's really what got me through that. And I continued. About that time, I actually met Chris's wife, and she became my sponsor. And Joe took me through the steps and the program in a way that I had never been through before. The way I'd known the program before that was I would call somebody, they'd give me advice, I'd feel a little bit better, and then I'd go on and just do the same stuff I'd been doing, you know, and then I'd wonder why I was getting the same result. And Joe really introduced me to how to become an inventory ninja, basically. I'd call her, you know, and at first she would listen to me. I mean, she stayed on the phone with me for a long time. I was very impressed. I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could listen to myself that long. I'd call her, and at first she'd listen to me, and then it kind of got to where it was like, well, it sounds like you have fear. You know what to do about that. Call me back when you've done what you're supposed to do. You know, click. And she's nicer than that. She didn't click. She didn't hang up, but she's fine. That doesn't bother me. I have three kids. But she really took me through how to do an inventory and how to look at, you know, I would call her and I'd kind of have some of it done, and she'd say, well, you didn't do this part, so no wonder you don't understand this part, you know. And that is something I can say in my sobriety has been a huge, huge important thing, is to really look at my fear and my resentment and, you know, look at the causes, like what it's affecting, and then getting through all the columns and then going back and looking at like, okay, well, what would it look like to do that if I was a woman of faith, courageous, considerate, honest, all of these things, you know, the opposites basically. And then starting to put that into practice, and then I started to get what you guys have probably heard Chris say all the time is that firsthand experience with doing it differently, you know, what that felt like. And a lot of times I would call Jo because I really wanted to have comfort, you know, I'd want to be comforted, and she kept pointing me back to my relationship with my higher power and the step work. And then also going back in and really working with other people. You know, because stuff seems really big and really important and really awful until I get on the phone with somebody, you know, who's going through something, and I get out of myself and I help them, and then I get off the phone and I forgot what I was upset about, you know. So in this time after I got divorced, I decided to become a yoga teacher, and I went to teacher training and became a yoga teacher, and I now teach people how to teach yoga at the 200 and then at the advanced level. And that was a dream of mine, you know, that I never would have been able to do if I'd been drinking. Like, I never would have been able to have that life. I wouldn't be able to have kids, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to take care of my children. And I can tell you none of my children have ever seen me drink, you know. And that's something that I'm probably the most proud of out of all of it. So I got divorced, and I started teaching yoga, and I, you know, navigated my way through a divorce with a person who's still sober and who actually is, I talked to him on the phone today, and, you know, we were talking about he's a good friend of mine. He's my friend, you know, and that's recovery. That's not, you don't go through a divorce where, you know, stuff happens that's unfortunate, and then you get to the other side of it, and your friends, and your co-parenting, and it's healthy, you know, and like everybody's happy. That's recovery. That's not me left to my own devices. So then after about 6 years of being a student, when am I talking till? 8:20? Oh, I need to slow down. I mean, the drunkologue is so boring to me now. It's like, I know. Chris and Joe would tell us when you'd share at our home group 1313 that you should give your drunkologue a little bit because we talk about solutions so much. And it's like, I've gotten so used to talking about solution, and I'm so far, it's you're so far away from it. It's almost like you forget about it. But, well, I was teaching yoga, and I was about 6 years into the whole single mom thing, and I met my second husband, and we got married, and I did the same thing I did with the first one. I got pregnant, and then I got married, which is no consequence to me, but so we have a 10-month-old baby girl. So I have a 12-year-old son and a 9-year-old daughter and a 10-month-old baby girl, Kate. And so let me go back. I'll go back and I'll tell you a little bit more about how I got here. So like I said, I started drinking when I was in middle school. And the first time I drank, I got really drunk. I was at the Crawfish Festival. Did any of y'all ever go to the Crawfish Festival in spring? Yeah. A couple of y'all know that. And I was so, you know, this gives you a picture of how young I was. I was wearing white Keds. And I had gone to this party, and they had my friend's older sister, and they had trash can punch, which is just like a cooler with Kool-Aid and whatever you could steal from your parents. And you just, everybody brought it and poured it in the cooler, and you drank it. And I just, that very first night, just drink after drink after drink. And I had thrown up eventually, of course, and I had thrown up on my little white innocent Keds. And I remember my mom seeing him the next day. It's like, what happened? And I said, well, I drank some Hawaiian punch, and I was laughing really hard, and I spit it out, and I spit it on my shoes, you know. But what's significant about that is I remember thinking, like, oh, I can just lie. Like, that was my first experience with, like, I can just lie, and it'll be fine. You know, I can do whatever I want. And so all through, you know, middle school and high school, You know, and keep in mind, I'm living in the suburbs of Houston, you know, a pretty good, you know, I went to Klein High School, if any of y'all are familiar with that area, you know, I had it pretty good, you know, and, but what I did have also was the thing that we all have of just like that, I don't know what else to call it, but like a soul sickness. It's like I never quite fit in. I was like that square peg, round hole. Like I just couldn't seem to get it right. And I did. I was raised by people that expected me to be a certain way, and I just never really could be that way. And so I continued to just, finally, I think I just got the fuck it, you know, and I was like, I can't forget it, you know. You've met my mother. Very sweet lady, right? Yeah. But anyway, so I continued to, you know, go to some pretty bad situations in Houston. You know, you can get yourself into some good amount of trouble in Houston, as you can in any town. But if you live there, you know, it's a fun town. So I went off to college in Nashville, Tennessee. And I had, my parents paid for everything, you know, I had a free ride, and I was a music student, I was a vocal major, and I think like my first overdose I ever had was in high school, but my second one was when I was about my first year of college, and you know, I remember just calling up my parents at one point and just saying, you know, I think I'm just going to take a break for a little while, you know, and really what was happening was that I was drinking and doing so many drugs. And, you know, I was one of those people that kind of, I had one of these like Chinese silk coin purse things that was full of pills. And it was just like a constant chemistry experiment. You know, it's like, oop, I overshot the mark there. I'll just take this. And then that'll settle that off. And then that was too far that way. So then I'd, you know, just do a little of this. And I'm sure y'all are familiar. And, so, you know, and then I start bartending and I'm taking dexedrine and, you know, doing the whole thing. And I overdosed about four times. You know, I remember one night one of my friends, you know, had a dinner party and she had some of these Vanderbilt football players over, and I was doing tequila shots with these huge Vanderbilt football players. And at the end of her dinner party was me getting pulled out of the apartment on a stretcher, you know, and puking all over her nice carpet, you know, hanging off the stretcher, throwing up. And she just wanted to have a dinner party with some Vanderbilt football players. And I, you know, went out with a bang. So it was just, I don't know, it was always like that. You know, if I decided to drink, anytime I put it in my body, I didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, what's really great is it was explained to me that I basically have a physical allergy, right? Which is fine if I don't put it in my body. So if, let's say I'm allergic to strawberries and I go to Whole Foods, you know, and I stand in front of the strawberries and obsess about the strawberries, you know, but if I just don't put them in my body, it'll be okay. It's the same thing with alcohol. But the thing is, I have a mind that's obsessed that someday, somehow, the story is going to be different and I'm going to be able to put it in my body, and the story's not going to go the way it's gone every single time, you know. And then coupled with that, then we have, you know, what was explained to me is a spiritual malady. So when I came into AA, you know, it would be great if I just stopped drinking, you know, and that could solve the problem. But unfortunately, when I stop drinking and I don't do anything about my spiritual condition, then I'm just kind of a miserable person and it's awful to be around. So when I came in, you know, I right away got into the work, and I'm really lucky, and I realized that I'm not the norm in that way. I've never relapsed. I've been sober for almost 14 years, and it's not a part of my story. So I share that just to say it doesn't have to be, you know. But I did right away get into the work. And if my sponsor told me to jump, I said, how high? You know, and that was the thing. You know, I had to take a hard look at myself and what I was doing in my life and where I had caused wreckage, and not just in the lives of others, but my own life, you know, and look at the choices that I was making. And I think that's really the key to this program. I think that's really what keeps you sober, and maybe that's what the difference is. You know, it's like people say things like meeting makers make it and all, and I do think that's true. I do think the community is a huge piece of it, but I think you really have to sit down and look at the causes and conditions at some point and start to figure out, like, what am I doing over and over and over thinking that I'm going to get a different result? And it keeps showing up the same way. And when I first came in, that it was alcohol, you know, it was like, I kept thinking that somehow, some way I could do some, you know, like it would end differently, and it just never did. So I'm in college and, you know, I drop out and I'm spending, you know, summers with, you know, summers with friends with, you know, bags of mushrooms. Like, we're going to sell these mushrooms and then we just eat the mushrooms all summer. You know, I mean, just stuff like that. It's like, I named cats, you know, based on when I was on mushrooms. And, you know, it's just, but it was always kind of fun at first, you know, and then it got to where it just wasn't, oh, look at that baby. It stopped being fun. You know, it was like, the disease had taken hold, and it wasn't, I couldn't not drink. And then when I did drink, you know, horrible things were happening. And then I had to drink more to forget about the things that had happened. So, in about 2003, I moved here. I moved to Austin from Nashville, and I kind of thought, all right, well, I'll just move and maybe things will be different. I'll be closer to my family. And, you know, I got a job bartending, and I was drinking and bartending and just doing that whole life. And then, but I think, you know, I never went to jail. I didn't lose a house. I didn't lose a family. I didn't, you know, but what did happen was that, that kind of, like I said, that soul sickness, you know, I didn't want to drink anymore, but I didn't want to live either. You know, it was like, I couldn't imagine life without it. And, that was really like the jumping off point for me, you know? I was living in an apartment that looked onto South Congress Avenue, or, you know, whatever it is. Is it Avenue? And like I said, there wasn't anything on the outside. If you were to look at my life, you wouldn't have gone, man, she, you know, doesn't she know? You know, I mean, you could look at it from the outside and it just didn't seem, but what was happening was basically by the end of it, you know, I was drunk every day. I was in my apartment by myself. If I had to go to work, I worked at South Congress Cafe, and I would go to, what's that Mexican food restaurant that's right down the street? That's Guero's. And I would have a couple of margaritas, let's be honest. And then I would go work. And then I would get off work and I would get drunk and I would do what we do when we get drunk. And then I would get up the next day and I would do it all over again. You know, and it was just, I always like to say this too, because I smoked a lot of weed. And I know that there's some argument about the marijuana maintenance program, but what I can say about that is that when I would smoke weed, you know, nothing ever happened, but nothing ever happened. I would sit on my couch, you know, Maybe I'd get up in the morning and wake and bake and have some coffee and clean my house for a second. But, you know, I mean, eventually it was just like nothing ever happened. And I had had all the opportunities that I think most people don't have. And I had had all these aspirations and all these things that, you know, and a full ride to go to school. And it was all gone. And I was sitting in an apartment, you know, just bartending and staying drunk. And in that time, you know, I had overdosed and gone to the hospital, and some of them were on accident and some of them were on purpose, you know, and I just couldn't fucking die. And I really tried. And it was that moment in that parking lot, you know, with my drug dealer sitting next to me saying, you know, it's not that bad. You're going to be all right, you know? And I just thought, this is never going to be any different, and I can't do this anymore. And, so it, like I said, I came into the meeting and, you know, I went to Westlake and I would sometimes go twice a day, you know, I had nothing else to do, you know, and that was very much my thing. I was like, I can't do anything else. I am getting sober, you know, so I can't do that. And I can't have that responsibility. I've got to get sober. And, you know, I started waiting tables and I would just go to meetings and I would go to coffee after the meetings. You know, we'd go to Magnolia Cafe and sit there until they closed and just after those 10:30 meetings. And then I would go home and I could never sleep. And so I remember I listened to Bill Clinton's book on audio, and that's what would put me to sleep, you know, because it was so fucking boring. I'd be out like a light. And then I would get up and I would go to work, go to a meeting, you know, go hang out, do service work, meet with my sponsor, do step work. And that was literally my life. And I remember, like, for the first 3 months, the first 90 and 90, it was like that. And then I remember getting to 90, 90 and being like, what do I do now? And it was like the same thing. Keep going. You know, and so my first sponsor, we went through all the steps and she was perfect. And then my second sponsor was an older woman with, I think, like 30 years of sobriety, and she was perfect. And, you know, I look back on that first 5 years of sobriety and I think, holy cow, you know, I was a wreck. It was, but it was so much better than the way I'd been living. You know, I mean, I was married to somebody that is successfully in the music business, and we had this big life, and we had kids, and we traveled a lot, and but you know, I still hadn't a clue who I was, you know, and hadn't a clue. I mean, I had been living like an animal, and then I was driving a station wagon with like car seats in the back of it, you know, and I had no idea how to do that. You know, I knew how to get drunk and I knew how to do drugs and I knew how to manipulate and lie and get my way and all of those good, awesome skills, but I had no idea how to be a parent or be a wife or be responsible. And so, you know, I'd show up to the meetings and, you know, you guys like, I'd be in the meetings and everybody was showered and they were happy and, you know, they were talking about their lives and these things that were, you know, just the shower and the happy was good enough for me. But then they started talking about, you know, essentially like their Cadillac problems. And I was like, I want those problems, you know, and now I have them. It's kind of funny. But I saw that y'all, lived the way that I lived, but we're happy and we're now, there was some peace. You had peace. And that was what I had never had. I never thought in a million years that I'd be a person that would have a peaceful life. And that really appealed to me. So I kept coming back because I wanted what people had in those meetings. And I hung on every single word. And, But I can tell you, for the first 5 years, and that was the first first marriage I was in, I had not a clue what I was doing. And I was sponsored the whole way through it, and actually, you know, but I had developed a dependency. I had traded the dependency I'd had on drugs and alcohol for people. You know, anytime something was wrong, I'd pick up the phone and I'd get some advice, and then, you know, I'd like, okay, I'll try that. And I hadn't really, what the book calls, you know, enriched or enlarged. Is it enriched or enlarged my spiritual life? He said, I used to drink. I don't remember. You know, I had failed to really enrich my spiritual life, because it's like the people and places and the things around me were really my higher power. Like that station wagon and that husband and that life had really been my higher power. So when it fell apart, I had to really like develop a real program. You know, I had to really start to develop a relationship with a higher power. It was like where the rubber really met the road. And that was, like I said, when I started working with Joe. And, you know, she would tell me all the time that I was powerless and that I was a victim. You're a victim of the delusion that somehow, some way you can wrest satisfaction out of the situation. And that's something I've become quite a black belt over the course of my sobriety, is managing well. You know, if I just could manage well. So what that means is, if I can just make everything, including you, go the way that I think it needs to go, everything will be okay. And, you know, life's just not like that. People are just not like that. So I had to develop some kind of relationship with a higher power, so that when things didn't go the way that I wanted them to, or the way I thought they should, or when they just completely fucking fell apart, I knew I would be okay. And I didn't know that before I came to this, before I got sober. Yeah, I thought my feelings would kill me. You know, I have an emotion and I'd be like, I can't feel this. I have to completely get wasted so I don't feel this, because it's going to kill me. And at about 5 years, that's when I started, you know, really developing a relationship with a higher power. And by that, I didn't start going to church. And I know that's what some people do, and I think that's wonderful. But for me, it really was, you know, turning my will and my life over to the care of God, that I actually didn't understand at all. But I saw the evidence of it in my life every day. I saw the difference, you know. And so I always think of third step as a decision to work the rest of the steps. And then that's when Joe repeatedly pointed me back to the fourth step. And over and over and over, I was doing these inventories. And it was just, you know, it started out where it would be like, I'd have to have, like, the incense and the pillows, and I'd have this perfect thing, and I'm going to write this inventory, and then everything's going to be better, and I'm going to understand. And it just never, it's not like that. You know, I can tell you I've written inventories about the same things multiple times, and I'm not doing anything wrong. It's just that the inventory is not a punishment, and it's not necessarily that everything's going to become clear. I'm going to be able to, what I do get out of it is I get to see how my third column, or what, you know, what's affected, is so wrapped up, you know, me getting those needs met from people. So it's like, I'm getting my self-esteem and my pride and especially my security. Now, I love to get my security from other people. My emotional security, you know, which is basically, if you're not acting the way that makes me feel secure, then, you know, I'm fucked. So I had to figure out, like, okay, well, what does it mean, you know, to get that from a higher power? Well, and it was explained to me by Joe, you know, that self-esteem comes from esteemable acts. So by doing the inventories and trying to see where I had, where my part was and where I was getting my needs met from, you know, all my third column needs met, and then putting it back basically with me and God and going, okay, I'm going to act in this way, you know. And I started to get that firsthand experience, and I started to get a little bit of faith that, like, it was going to be okay if, you know, I trusted this process and I didn't have to have it be a certain way. And I'm still a work in progress. I'm still not very good at it. Like, you could probably, my husband could probably stand up here and tell you a different story. But for me, that was key. That changed my sobriety. It changed my life. I no longer was dependent on the world and its people for, you know, to be okay. And I think that's, you know, a lot of probably what drove me to drink and do drugs, you know. And so started, you know, working all that and kind of, I'm still doing that, you know. And that's the thing about it is I'm sure at times y'all probably have people say, oh, you still go to meetings? Or I have people say that to me, oh, you still go to those meetings? I'm like, yeah, I need them. You know, I have a women's group that I go to on Saturday morning called Fire Makers. And I swear those women have like laser beams coming out of their eyes. You know, they're just, they've been sober for a long time. And I listen to them talk and I'm just like, you know, the stuff that, the stuff that you go through in the program. I listen to women who have lost children, whose husbands have Alzheimer's, who, you know, gone through divorces, who've, you know, lost their homes, and they don't drink. And they don't get drunk. They don't get drunk and they don't do drugs. So, and that's my story too, is that you can live through anything and you don't have to drink. There's nothing that a drink will make better. No matter how much pain you're in at the time, there's nothing that a drink will make better. And I've had moments in my sobriety where I was in so much pain, I wasn't confused about whether or not I was an alcoholic, but I just didn't want to be in pain anymore. You know, and that's when I really had to reach to the women in the program and say, how did you get through with, you know, what I'm going through sober? And with some grace and dignity too, you know, it's not everything has to be holding on until there's, you know, everything, what's that saying? Everything I've ever let go has claw marks on it. You know, not everything does have to be like that. It's like pain doesn't actually have to always be the touchstone for growth. I'm here to say that discomfort, like a little bit of discomfort can be the touchstone for growth. It doesn't, you don't have to set the house on fire, you know, to want to do it different. And, you know, I've worked this program, I've worked steps on being a mom and how to talk to my children and how to show up for them. I've worked steps on how to be an ex-wife. Trust me, I've worked a shit ton of steps on that one. You know, I've worked steps on the people that I work with. You know, I'm a yoga teacher, but, you know, we're all there because we're not all here, okay? We're not... I always, like, I think you and I have even laughed about this, of like, you know, we do yoga not because we are yogic, but because we need that stuff. Most of us are pretty, you know, we're bouncing off the walls. And, you know, so I've worked steps on the people that I work with. There's nothing that this program, you know, I can apply my alcoholism to anything and I can apply the solution to anything. Because when I got here, you know, I had to learn how to live without alcohol and drugs. And now I've been here long enough that, you know, I'm just like, you know, yoga, sometimes the you know, they'll talk about the goal being enlightenment. And I'm like, my goal is really more like radical okayness. Like, I'm radically okay in my own skin, you know, and that is really a miracle. You know, I know y'all have heard a lot of people say this, but I really do have a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. If you had told me I was going to get divorced, I'm like, well, that sounds really terrible. It's one of the best things that ever happened to me. You know, if you told me I was going to be a drug addict and alcoholic, I'm like, that sounds really terrible. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. You know, my alcoholism and my addiction is not, it's not a tragedy. It's not a story of tragedy. It's a story of hope. It's a story of recovery and continued recovery and continued work. So if you stay sober and you do the work and you get in the steps, you help other people, and you develop a a relationship with whatever your understanding of God is, your life will get better. I've seen it a million times. You know, and I've seen it go the other way too. But I can definitely say that it works if you work it. I think that's good. That's good.